Well, g'day, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Matt Cranston, who is currently the economics correspondent for the Australian newspaper and was formerly, for the last 4 years, the Washington D-based correspondent for the Australian Financial Review. Today we discuss his impressions gained from living in Washington, D.C. during one of the most momentous times in history, whether Australians really get the MAGA movement, and who might be looking out for us in the new Trump administration, tariffs, and today's market meltdown, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Matt Cranston, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thanks, Dan. Good to be here.
And welcome back to Australia, because you've spent, the last four years in Washington, D.C.?
Just shy of 4 years.
Yeah, right. There's a lot going on in the world today as we speak. I mean, the markets, I think, are down about 4% in Australia. The Aussie dollar's under 60%. And everyone wants to talk about Trump's favorite word in the English language. But I thought I'd just ask a few setting questions first about your time in DC, because I think people will be interested in that. What do you think, what surprised you most about your time there?
Oh, well, I think it's when I first arrived, I thought I could see the wood from the trees, that Republicans were red, Democrats were blue, and that this is what they thought of, and this is what this party thought of. But as you get into the woods, as you get more submersed in it all, you see that it's not like that. There is no black and white. There are Republicans who are very liberal. There are Democrats who are less progressive than you would have thought. There are obviously, I mean, some of the obvious things are that the Democrats are much more protectionist than Republicans. And now we see that the Republican leader is more protectionist than the Democrats. So just little things like that. And also around the social perspective as well. I won't go too much into detail there, but that's basically, I think, the biggest thing that surprised me was, you know, just the way, depending on your electorate and depending on the people that you need to vote you in, that's what dictated what you really think, not so much along party lines. Mm. And, that's probably the most obvious thing that I picked out in my time there.
The U.S. Media, specifically the Washington Press Corps, has come in for a lot of criticism in the last 4 years. And there's been, you know, dramatic changes in the U.S. media landscape. What did you make of them up close?
Okay, this is a good question because it's something I wanted to get off my chest, but I've never had really the platform for explaining it because you don't want to be one of these journalists who undermines your fraternity. But I did see, I did see a lot of BS over there. And what I mean by that is you do see an extraordinary amount of bias in the media. The objectivity and the value of objectivity is just not there as much as it used to be. Okay, so some examples, huh? Given this is a conservative podcast, I might just pick a conservative angle on this, but I was there for Roe v. Wade. I was there when the judgment got leaked first. So you had to write a story saying, well, this is what's going to happen. Then I was there for the decision and I went up and outside the Supreme Court. And because the Supreme Court is in Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. is 97% Democrat, you're only really going to have local protesters turn up unless there's a massive organized campaign, for example, the March for Life, which happens once a year, and they get a good up to 50,000 people, which is a pro-life organization. But in this situation, you would go up there and you would talk to people and so forth. And I wonder whether or not that dynamic of who turns up outside the Supreme Court is what influences basically 80% of the mainstream media to write articles saying that this was bad, to overturn it, that the Roe v. Wade decision is undermining all these women's rights and all these aspects to the abortion debate. And it was sort of interesting because, like, there's so many different ways you could write a story saying, well, look, actually, there's millions and millions of people, women in America, who are very much in favor of overturning Roe v. Wade. And, you know, you would see heaps and heaps of stories in the mainstream media about abortion clinics being firebombed, but you wouldn't see hardly any stories about the pregnancy centers where they were being vandalized and facing a hard time as well. And it's just, I mean, that's just, I may have misspoken on some aspects there. I don't know, but I've got to be sensitive. But the thing is, that was just something that was really prominent, which is that the mainstream media will go, this is a conservative thing, and this is my view, and this is the view of what I see in a very Democrat stronghold. And they don't reflect the other side, which is that there are huge numbers of people that were against Roe v. Wade, and including Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who said that the law was actually, badly interpreted and shouldn't have happened.
Yeah. What about the conservative media? Because it always strikes me the US has a much more dynamic conservative press than we are in Australia. And they have DC offices, right? But the impression that I've got over the last sort of, well, almost since Trump announced his candidacy back in 2015, is that it has taken the conservative press a long time to sort of work out his agenda. And still many are quite critical, right?
Yeah, I think the conservative media in America has been emblazoned or has exploded through new platforms, new technology. That's what has really created this huge new drive. And I think that, when you hear people like Elon Musk talking about legacy media, it's not just a joke and a jibe. It's actually, there's an element of truth to it, which is that the platforms are now changing. There's more relevance to podcasts, right? Like, I think when Trump was on his campaign, he would do a podcast with these two young blokes. I've just forgotten their name. They were one's a wrestler and a boxer, but they got millions of people. Well, they got the New York, the equivalent of the New York Times readership in one hit. And so all these new platforms are allowing people to express their view, but it's not traditional journalism in the sense that it's quite biased on that side as well. So they're very pro this or in favor of that. And it can be much more commercially driven as well. For example, they might be all linked to crypto and so forth. So they want to give, it's sort of like a commercial transaction in some cases, like, yeah, let's give this guy a platform, but we're going to get some regulation that's favorable for us or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you just got to watch. You don't just look at the ephemeral nature of the journalism, but go behind it and see what the commercial imperatives are. But yeah, I think that, I didn't really answer your question directly there, but I do think that when they approach Trump, it has shifted from, obviously Murdoch and Fox. It's sort of interesting. I went to the trial where Fox was being sued by Dominion, which was the voting machines.
Yeah.
And I read the documents before they went to court. And you could see in there the animosity towards Trump from Fox News. You know, the Tucker Carlson, who's a very close confidant to Trump, was there saying, you know, he sort of really abhorred him. It was quite incredible to read all that. And, you know, Murdoch himself even said some things. But I've got to be careful about that because I now work for Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, sure.
But it was just really interesting to see how that has shifted as well, because only a few weeks ago, Rupert Murdoch was sitting in the White House, and there's a great deal of a good, strong relationship there. And Trump's obviously said a lot of good things about Rupert as well.
Yeah. So in DC, again, just to properly understand the scene, you were there. There was Adam Crichton from The Australian as well. And then Kevin Rudd, obviously the ambassador, and then Joe Hockey, the former ambassador who now runs his lobbying operation. Which other Australians based in DC do you think have access or connections to the Trump White House?
Very few. Obviously, you know, there's a, obviously, either papers have mentioned this before, but there's a young bloke called Phil Hancock who is Australian, and he's right in there amongst it all as well. I mean, he was right there alongside Trump during the campaign, and you know, he's a young, bright fellow, and he's right amongst it. But there's not a lot of other Australians, really. I mean, you know, Arthur Sinodinos was actually the ambassador in between Rudd and Hockey. There's a few others around the place. I mean, obviously, Scott Morrison has got a presence now in the US with his company, Space Center Australia. And he's doing, he's just done some work with NASA, and he's doing a lot there. Tony Abbott comes in as well from time to time. He's sort of linked in with the 2042 group, which is the Taiwanese independence group. That's sort of interesting. They like his sort of hawkish outlook on China. There's obviously other journos too. ABC have got quite a presence. You know, they've got, I think, about three or four journalists. So that was always a thorn in my side in a way, because, you know, I'm trying to cover one story one day and another story, and they've got three journalists to cover all stories in one hit. So
always the way.
Always put a bit of pressure on me, but it was fun. It was great, Dan, honestly, going through the White House, and I was there for the first press conference with Carolyn Leavitt, and you know, it was really extraordinary. I got there 40 minutes early, and just to make sure I got a place, and by the end of it, I was sort of, my back was right up against the wall. It was very humid, and it was very intense. And then, of course, Pentagon. You go to the Pentagon and you do all that, and I'm on the Secretary of Defense's jet with him, interviewing over the Pacific. And you go to Congress, and these politicians come out of hearings, and you go up to Elizabeth Warren and you ask her some pertinent questions, and she just stonewalls you and all that sort of thing. So it's great fun, actually. But it's very tiring and it's very exhausting.
Yeah. Do you think any of the Australians based in Washington understand or support the MAGA agenda?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, a friend of mine, Alex Butterworth, he's an executive at Uber, but he's got a side hobby, which is restaurateuring. He recently found out that he had ADHD, and he needed to exercise the demons of that by going and putting a whole heap of money into a restaurant and figuring out what paintings to put on the wall and the design elements and all that sort of thing. Now, I'll tell you this story because he's an Australian and he's a former Liberal Party operative, and he's got this restaurant where all the MAGA people go to. It's MAGA headquarters now. I actually wrote a story about this. Steve Bannon turned up, and he's right in amongst it. But I think Alex tries to maintain a very neutral setting on that. So whilst he would be clued in to a lot of the MAGA people, and of course he co-owns it with a pretty ultra MAGA person as well, but I just think he tries to sort of project a more neutral position on it, because he likes to be more about the restaurant as opposed to trying to have an influence in politics.
Is that, and that's inside the Capitol building, is it, the restaurant, or where is it located?
No, it's not. It's about, you could walk from the Capitol building to the restaurant. It's probably less than, it's about 500 meters away from it on Capitol Hill, though. It's on Capitol Hill, which is the name of a suburb in Washington, not far from Union Station.
Got it. So our current ambassador still is Kevin Rudd, who I've followed closely for a while. People are familiar with in Australia. He famously, prior to Trump getting back in the second time, called the current president of the United States a traitor to the West, the most destructive president in history. And then Trump, in response, said he was not the brightest bulb and was nasty. I'm just laying it out there in case people forget. These were the direct quotes. Why do you think it is that on a bipartisan basis in Australia, people have been so keen for him to continue in that role? Because it does not seem to me, at least from a distance, that he is, you know, temperamentally right, or certainly ideologically in any way sort of aligned with the Trump agenda.
I've had a bit to do with the ambassador, I think it's fair to say that he's highly intelligent and he understands China very well. And I think that in the time that he's been there, he's made a concerted effort to ingratiate himself with Republicans and Team Trump. So I think if you just look at what he's done and the job that he has to do, that he's actually done that. He's sort of done the job that he's required to do, well, at least put in a hell of an effort. It's extraordinary to think that someone who said all those things, including, I don't think you mentioned Village Idiot as well, is now in that position with Trump there, because Trump's a very sensitive person, actually. And I think you'll remember this. And no matter what effort Rudd puts in, it's just so hard to sit there facing someone who's called you all these things. I've read Kevin's book twice and I've gone through and collated the things he said about Trump, and there's like 12 disparaging sort of comments that are still, you know, in print. So it is an extraordinary contradiction. But, you know, I just think that, and I think also there's been a little bit of a shift in the way people think about subsidized industrialization policy. You know, China in the last decade, and certainly has become a much more powerful force in government subsidies. And that is akin to a tariff in a way, like an inverted tariff. You know, when Adam Smith and Ricardo and all these people are talking about free trade, they sort of didn't really think through the might and of China and what China does now to make it an unfair playing field. And don't get me wrong, I'm a free trader and so forth, but I think Rudd sort of does get a little bit more of this. He will say that he's still openly a free trader, and that he is in his own, and that he's sort of like lost because most of the Republicans and Democrats now have jettisoned their belief in the free trade system. But I still think he would appreciate some elements to part of it, including the national security element of making sure that you onshore as much of the critical parts of your supply chain as you can. But yeah, that's only a very small part of what Trump's doing with tariffs. It's not the core rationale to it. But Rudd understands that core national security rationale to it all. And yeah, it's probably a long-winded answer for
no,
you.
No, it's all right. I mean, I'm highly critical of Kevin Rudd, and I think his China reputation is overstated. And I think, you know, if you're going to him for what the future holds there, then you have to consider that he had no idea that even in 2 years' time, a president in the United States speaking English would come back. So certainly, you know, prognostications about the future should be held with, you know, taken with some degree of salt. He described himself as a free trader. Sorry?
You probably speak better Mandarin than he does.
Oh, Dad. He's good. He speaks like an ABC newsreader in Chinese, but it's I've for my sins read through a lot of his books too, and you know, maybe that's an entirely
I'm not making excuses for him.
Do you think in 2022 anyone in the circles in Washington thought Trump would come back in as president?
There's some people in my circles who thought they did. But in Washington, probably not. Yeah. I mean, I did have to put in a prediction at the beginning of 2024 in the Financial Review, which is the last place I worked, about who would win. And this was right at the, you know, this was sort of getting towards the low point. But it was right before the Iowa caucuses that I had to write it. And he had a little bit of a momentum, but he had all the 91 criminal charges in front of him. He had just so much coming towards him in terms of legal cases that most people really thought Nikki Haley or Ron DeSantis would make it. But I said Trump would win, and that's in black and white well before a year. I mean, about a year before the election. And I did that because, Dan, I didn't stay in Washington, D.C. when I did this job. Yeah. I traveled to 48 states of America, 48 states, cool. Some of them multiple times. I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, which had one of the biggest votes for Trump. I went to Tech, you know, I went to all these places, and I went to South Dakota. But, you know, so I just had a better feel for what was going on, I think. And it was a very hard call to make because of the fact that he had so much historical, a lack of historical precedents. You know, there'd never been, I think Ulysses S. Grant was the only president ever charged with a crime beforehand for speeding through a town on a horse. and Trump was the only one else. And then there had never been a president that was convicted of a criminal charge. So you had all this going on, and you know, then he was losing so much money too. So there were all these pressures on him. But and then of course two assassination attempts, which was extraordinary too. But I can get to that later.
Oh, no, talk about that. What do you know about the assassination attempts?
Well, I tell this story quite freely, but I was at a Trump rally in Pennsylvania the week before he went to another rally, i.e. the Butler, Pennsylvania rally where he was shot. And I was at the rally and was in Philadelphia, which is the capital of Pennsylvania. And this is – Pennsylvania is important, Dan, because it was the most marginal state in the country. And the electorate, the seats in that state were really, really tight, and you had to win Pennsylvania to win the election. Mm. Anyway, so I turned up to this rally and I had not been able to get in on a media pass. So I had to basically sneak in. And as I snuck in, one of the Secret Service people came up to me and said, "Where's your pass?" And I didn't have it. And I said, "Well, look, I've got a White House correspondence badge." And I just showed that to him. And he was in his early 20s. And he just took that for, and it had like, you know, it was just nothing, that pass. I mean, it was a State Department issued thing, which can be helpful because that's a pretty important department. But he just went, "Okay, all right, no problem." And I was standing about 15 meters or less, probably less, away from Trump as he spoke. And that was a week before he was shot at another rally. And I was actually invited. What's that?
Why do you think it was so lax, that security?
I don't know. Yeah. And I always look around when I go to those things because I went to Warren Buffett, who's the, you know, who's once the richest man in the world, and he puts on an AGM every year. And I was up in the media stalls, and I came out of there, and I was in the heavy duty lift, and two guys with massive sniper rifles were in there, and I was like, "Wow, I didn't see you guys." And they were like, "Yeah, well, you know, we have." All sorts of people come into these things, and anything people can do anything to prominent people. And I was so now when I went to all the Trump rallies, I was always looking out for where the snipers were parked, and always keen and interested in seeing all that security dynamic. And I was actually invited to the Butler, Pennsylvania rally, and I was going to be seated in one of the front rows. Yeah, so, right. And the only reason I didn't go was because I had been locked in to go to the Republican National Convention that Monday. And so getting from Philly on the Saturday night or the Sunday morning, because you'd stay there, back up to DC was just too much risk in case something was delayed. So I had to miss the Saturday night rally so that I could make sure I got my flight to the RNC on Monday. So, you know, could have been shot, could have been part of history.
Yeah, but, it's still very mysterious, that, and hopefully more information will come out in due course about what went on in Pennsylvania. By the way, Harrisburg is the capital of Pennsylvania, not Philadelphia. There you go.
US trivia.
One thing, it's interesting.
I always get confused because of the Liberty.
Oh, there are all these, like, I'm just being a smart ass. Yeah. There are all these little trick questions.
No, I love it. It's great. I went to Harrisburg as well.
In
fact, one of my favorite little spots, Dan, and you can just, sorry, leave this out. It's a bit too trivial, but is a place called Lancaster County, which was very influential in the election. But it was also the place where great Australian film director Peter Weir shot Witness with Harrison Ford. Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I loved that film a lot and had wonderful music. I think Ennio Morricone, it might have been, or someone. And, and so I went there to the town of Intercourse where it was all set and interviewed the Amish people, went up to them on their farms and really enjoyed it, really loved it. It's beautiful seeing the sunset in the afternoon and these wagons with horses rolling past. Getting home before the sun sets. It's just a really beautiful, beautiful part of the world.
Can you go just visit as a tourist the Amish community, or do you have to get...
Sure you can. But you can just go as a normal person. Like, people were turning up to the dairy and just buying milk from the dairy.
Yeah.
I turned up as a journalist and interviewed them and said, "Look, you know, this is what I'm doing." And they're very interested people. Like, when you go up to them, and if you're genuine and you're not just like looking at them as if a species of animal in a funny hat, you know, if you're actually sort of like interested in what they think and what they say, they're actually very accommodating and they're interested in you as well. But they're an interesting group of people, and I had a really enjoyable time, just 2 or 3 days there, going through it and interviewing them, and because they were actually quite important in this election.
I think they turned out for Trump quite in a big way.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Hey, what do you Americans always have this really generally have a fondness for Australia, but they also have a bit of a cluelessness about the realities of Australia. What did you impressions did you get speaking to senior politicians there and influence makers about how what they think of Australia over the next sort of 4 years and how we'll be treated?
AUKUS is the big thing. You know, it used to be kangaroos and Hogan barbecue and just all the tourism and all that sort of thing. You know, and a bit of mateship, i.e., you know, we've fought on every battleground since World War One and all that sort of thing. But AUKUS is the big thing now because that's the thing that Congress passed so quickly. You know, people say AUKUS has gone slow, but that's actually not correct. AUKUS has gone very fast because if you look at how much legislation Congress passes and the difficulty in getting anything through Congress, and suddenly you see AUKUS got congressional approval. It's an act of their parliament, basically. And Australia also got reprieves on the most stringent export licenses on military equipment, which is under the ITAR, the International Trafficking of Arms Regulation, which is an enormous thing to get. So AUKUS is very much prominent in a lot of congressional members' minds. They know that if you take China seriously as a threat in the Pacific and the aggression China has showed, that, you know, China is now a very bipartisan issue in Congress, and they know that Australia is a strategically important place. But also, there is a sense among some people, and not this is not my belief, but there is a sense among some people that there is great danger for Australia in whether or not the US would be there, whether or not Trump really would be there if there was some sort of action towards Australia. It's a little bit of a risk that needs to be assessed. You know, yes, the Americans have 2,000 Marines up in Darwin, and they've got 9 B-52 bombers sitting on the tarmac, and they've got Pine Gap as well, which is an extraordinarily important asset for signals and intelligence in the Southern Hemisphere. But you just wonder, like, what's Trump's view on Taiwan? What's Trump's view on Ukraine? What's Trump's view on Australia? What's the strategic importance for it? So there's a bit of that question as well. And then lastly, there is an element of, you know, Australia more recently has been pushing its superannuation wealth, which is the third or fourth biggest pool in the world, and they've some of the Americans, including the Commerce Sec Lutnick, who Kevin Rudd interviewed for an hour in the embassy in front of everyone, which is pretty good going. Like 3 days into your job, and you've got Lutnick on stage being interviewed. And I think they're starting to wake up to the fact that Australia is a pretty wealthy country in comparison to other countries, and there's value to be had there in strengthening the ties, both in capital, both militarily, and in some ways culturally as well. But I did do a story, Dan, early on in my first 4 years, because I came over to America during the middle of COVID, and one of the stories I did was on how many Americans were cancelling their plans to go to Australia, all because of the way Australia handled COVID. They hated with a passion the way in which Dan Andrews' government handled COVID and lockdowns. They thought it was just, you know, real Bolshevik territory.
They were right.
Well, of course they were, and it was such an easy story to write. And you can read that on the Financial Review website. But, you know, it's just, I had everyone, all these people who had made plans to go to Australia, and they were like, wow, this is what Australia does? I'm not going there. I'm not going to go risk being locked up and all this sort of thing. And they saw that famous image of that woman, that pregnant woman in her home being arrested by the police in her home for inciting not a riot, but a protest against the law of the land. And so I think that was really bad image for Australia. I think America and Australia still have a great affection for each other as well.
Yeah, I mean, America is so big and full of contradictions that I'm sure there was a constituency there that cheered on Jacinta Ardern and cheered on Dan Andrews as well. But yeah,
there are still people wearing masks around DC.
It's so global these days. The media, right? You can pick up on stories from
wherever. I mean, if they do not have some sort of separate illness and they're wearing a mask, it's got to be a political statement, doesn't it?
Yeah. Hey, so Trump has actually been to Australia. I think he came in the 80s, and he might have even had a Trump Tower or some sort of real estate project in Australia.
Well, he was going to build a casino.
That's right. Yeah, and JD Vance, as far as I can work out, has never been to Australia before. In the administration, who do you think thinks about Australia or is most well informed about Australia? And I don't know, is the person that has our sort of back within it?
It's an interesting question. It depends on the subject. I know that the Undersecretary of Defence, or is it the Deputy Undersecretary of Defence, Elbridge Colby, he knows Australia quite well, and he became quite familiar with me and one or two other journos because he worked for a think tank. I think it was the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative think tank in America. Mm. And he understands Australia, but his views on Australia are quite surprising in that when I discussed with him the purchase of three Virginia-class submarines under AUKUS, I said to him, do you think we'll get sovereignty over them? And if we do have sovereignty, will that be a strategic advantage against China and the Pacific? And his answer was quite surprising in the sense that he said, probably not get sovereignty. And if you did get sovereignty, it wouldn't make that much of a difference. And I said, really? But surely having a submarine outside Australia in the Tasman Sea is much more of a strategic advantage than having them sitting in a dock in San Diego. And he said, yeah, maybe, but not that big an advantage. And I said, but also what about the fact that if you had a submarine under a foreign sovereign, under an Australian control and command, surely that would be another uncertainty for China and China's gaming. They wouldn't know how Australia would operate that sub. So that would be an ambiguity that would add to an advantage. And he once again said, no, not really, because as soon as it becomes under Australian sovereignty, it becomes a code blue instead of a code green. And green and blue just mean green is friend and blue is sort of halfway between, and then red is adversary. So there were all these finite details in the way we think about it. And I was like really surprised. And that's his now Deputy Undersecretary of Defence, who advises on Pacific issues. So that's just one thing, right? So everyone's there. Everyone's sort of got an element of a knowledge about Australia, but everyone's got a different sort of view on how the Trump administration and people in it would see things differently.
Well, I mean, that's a name I'm familiar with. He was on Tucker Carlson. He's read stuff that he's written. And part of the reason he's got that position is because he was very critical of let's call it the George W. Bush foreign policy. He's a break from that tradition. I don't think in Australia people have moved on from that. I mean, we have a very different foreign policy position when it comes to our attitude towards Ukraine, for example, much less, much more all the way with Zelensky than is currently the case amongst many people in DC.
I think you're right, Dan.
Yeah. And likewise, much more skeptical of all the interventions that have gone on in the last 30 years, mainly in the Middle East and elsewhere. I mean, I don't know. The Australian attitude I find in the press tends to be very much those silly Americans that don't understand the true logic of the world, rather than thinking to ourselves, Jesus, these guys might, accepting that maybe they have got a point with both in foreign policy, with trade, immigration, and other areas. We dismiss them. I was reading the other day, John Howard, of all people, said, it's stupidity, the tariff that Trump has introduced. Well, okay, maybe you do, but I think that, and you're entitled to your opinion, but the guys in the administration, they're probably the most high-Q cabinet ministers that have ever sat around, the table in the White House. So how do you, why this, I think from an Australian perspective, why this sort of reluctance to engage with the MAGA agenda and think through these things in a more fulsome way? Do you get a sense of that with the people you're speaking to?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think you're right on quite a few things there. But just as a broader observation, if you just exclude the MAGA thing for just a second, I do agree with you that Australia is too disparaging and writes America off as a bunch of crazies. That's a silly narrative, really. They see America through the guise of the old commercial media narrative, gun shootings and NASCAR and silly movies and all that sort of thing. Yes, there's a lot of madness there, right? I mean, just if you look at the extreme views on the far LGBTQI and the gender liquidity movement, there's an element of craziness there, just that. I mean, I've got to be very careful about this, Dan, but there's certain aspects of, the gender fluidity thing that become highly irrational and highly emotive.
We have that too, Matt, in Australia. It's no less crazy in many respects than anything.
The point is that when I was in Washington, I felt as though it was ground zero for the most intelligent people in the world. There are people who are just absolute machines. They're robots in terms of their knowledge of everything from constitutional law to nuclear physics to just everything. It's just amazing. And sometimes I felt quite inadequate there, actually. Just these young
people. You have your strengths, mate. Don't let them overawe you. Yeah.
These young people coming up out of college and university wearing bow ties and suits and things and just so knowledgeable of the law and, clerking for high court judges in their early 20s and just amazing, amazing people. Military. I joined a group. I'm a Catholic, right? And I joined a group called the Leonine Forum, which is a young Catholic professionals group. And just the talent and the quality there. There are people who have got, they're 30 and they've got six kids and they're, got their own business and, you know, they're taking four of them to jiu-jitsu on Saturday and getting a discount. And but they're, you know, they're like the expert on within the whole of the world, and they're just the most amazing. Some of the people are just so amazing, and you just stand in awe of some of them as well. So I think, Australia, if they think that they're better than Americans, they probably need to think a little bit more deeply about that.
Yeah, I find some of those Americans are so impressive, but at some time I find them a bit exhausting, like just going in all sorts of different directions all at once. Even when they go on holidays, it's like there's no true downtime, right? They're always living the strenuous life, as you know Theodore Roosevelt used to kind of say. What do you think are likely to be the fissures in the MAGA coalition? I mean, there's probably already been a fair bit of ink spilt on the potential split between the more tech bro-y types and the more Steve Bannon types who you know think that it's not just all about cost cutting, and it's not all about importing high end labor to the United States, but that the reason why Trump was elected was on a different basis, and these new tech bros are a little bit Johnny come latelys to join the agenda, even though their money and their smarts in some ways are welcome. Do you think that's going to likely put tension on the coalition or not?
Yeah, well, I had to make a call in January about whether or not Elon and Trump would break their bromance, and it's a hard question. It's easier than just saying, you know, whether or not China's going to invade Taiwan, right? But it's actually really difficult to work out whether or not Elon and Trump will still be friends next year. I said they would be. If in the early days, Elon split with Trump because Trump got out of Paris Agreement, and Elon was pretty passionate about climate change and the Paris Agreement. Mm. This time there's quite a lot of passion from Elon about tariffs. He doesn't want tariffs. He wants free trade. He doesn't like subsidies. He wants a really free open market and free playing field. Elon's famous line, which I really love, is that intellectual property is for the weak. Which is really amazing, because he just thinks that if you need to protect your advantage in understanding something, then you're not at the front of the pack anyway, which is really extraordinary, I think. But anyway, so my point is that that's where I think the fissure will start to erupt. However, I actually think they're more canny than that, and the problem at the moment is that inside the Trump administration, you have people who are a little bit more, these tariffs are going to be too destructive. And then you have Peter Navarro's who are like, no, do tariffs, heaps of tariffs. And I think Elon, by saying that he doesn't want tariffs, is just softening the ground a bit for maybe Trump to do some reprieve deals and get a couple of deals going. He's a deal maker. He approaches his presidency as a deal making exercise, and I think that over time, as long as they can get something back and improve the trade dynamic and the restrictions on things for the US, then I think that that might turn out better than we think, and so That's where I think one fissure will end up. I think they're rock solid on the social and cultural issues. I think Trump has picked a team who are absolutely dyed-in-the-wool conservative in social policy, outside of Elon. But even Elon has in the recent years become even more socially conservative, even though he's a complete libertarian. You wouldn't think it from his Twitter posts, but his youngest son has transferred to a female, and now identifies as female. And so maybe I'm wrong in saying that the sun is, I don't know how to say it now, but that's become a major problem for Elon, and it's a deeply human problem for him, as opposed to just working out the latest SpaceX launch. You know, that's a rational, you know, problem that can be solved with money and smarts. But this is much more to his heart, Elon. And I think that is going to keep all of them in a close, binding sort of connection.
He has an interesting personal life, Elon, but he does care very strongly about the gender stuff because of what's happened to his son. On the tariffs, mate, I'm just half watching the markets as we speak. They're still down, although they've recovered slightly, probably in response to
how much are they down now, Dan?
The ASX 200 is down almost 3%, and the Aussie dollar's dipping under 60, but might be coming back a bit. In response to your comments, probably there you go. They're probably watching they're closely, but no, I'm joking. But on these tariffs, mate, I mean, it is the case that not everything can be done through executive order. And so the free trade agreement that Australia has negotiated with the United States will require to change fully, will require congressional changes to occur to make these things permanent, as will a whole lot of other changes that Trump has tried to do just by executive order at the moment. I guess, like, if you were Kevin Rudd or any sort of lobbyist there in Washington, D.C., you'd be walking the floors of Congress trying to influence, because it's very tight in Congress, right? You'd be trying to influence key decision makers there. Do you have any sense about that, whether, you know, there's likely to be, at least for Australia, reluctance from some of those congressmen to make any change to the US-Australia trade agreement?
Trump is doing this through, I mean, if you just want to check yourself, he's doing it through two powers, Section 301 and Section 232. Mm. 232 is about national emergency for economic impact, and 301 is just the standard tariff that he can do. Doesn't need congressional approval for those two.
They don't, but I had a long chat with a guy from Heritage about this, and it's still possible that those things can be challenged through administrative sort of law means. But
yeah, well, like everything else Trump's done, there's been a challenge.
Yeah, but my understanding, the agreement that was passed through Congress still does need to be changed with the Australia and the US, and as do a whole lot of other arrangements. So, you know, the Canada, Mexico proposal to revise things.
I should explore that more, given the role I have here I should. But I would just say, and I sort of wrote a story today in the Australian newspaper, for which I'm now the economics correspondent, and need to be across this stuff. But there is a sense that if these tariffs continue or are implemented in a way that creates too much financial instability, too much of an inflationary impulse, because, you know, inflation doesn't keep going up under tariffs. It rises and then stays at a level, right? Because tariffs are only implemented once and then they go. So, but if prices come back, if jobs are lost, if financial instability increases, then you're going to have a lot of Republican in tight electorates get pretty pissed off about this. And they're going to start voting against Trump's measures where they are able to be voted upon, including your dynamic with the FDA. And we've already seen four Republicans cross the floor in exempting Canada from the tariffs. So I think, you know, give it a few months and maybe we will see more pressure on Trump to unwind some of this stuff. And also, I think that will be part of the Australian strategy as well, is to wait a bit longer. And I interviewed Joe Manchin, who was one of the more controversial and famous senators, and, you know, called, in inverted commas, a good guy by Trump. And Manchin said,
Democrat, like from what state was he from? He's from one of those.
West Virginia.
West Virginia, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he became an independent very last minute in the last election. But he was saying that this is definitely sort of the way Australia should think about it, and that if you just give it time, don't attack Trump too much because he's a bit too sensitive on stuff. So don't get into name calling and just play your cards right. Then maybe, he said, Australia could be the first to get a reprieve from these tariffs.
Interesting. Hey, mate, fantastic to catch up. I've been meaning to do it for some time, but I know you've been busy, and you've got a fascinating beat and a great new role there at The Australian. It's going to be interesting times ahead, so great stories will be generated. If people want to follow you or find out more about you know, your coverage, what's the best way of getting in touch? You've got a Twitter handle as well as the Australian.
Yeah, I've got an X handle. You've got to acknowledge the name by which they want to be named. You know, whether it's Fraser Island or the Gulf of America. You have to acknowledge the people who that land or the ocean body of ocean belongs to. So the business is X. So I will call it I'm on X.
Okay.
Sorry if I'm being too facetious, but I know that I can have these jokes with you, Dan, because you're not politically correct. So there's that and LinkedIn, and I don't really get on Facebook, but yeah, they're the two. Sure.
Australian, you'll be covering the economics there full time and following regular stories.
That's right. I mean, I got back on a Saturday 2 weeks ago, and on Monday I was preparing for the federal budget with Treasurer Jim Chalmers, having to ask him questions straight off the bat. So I've dived into it. It's been a baptism of fire. And yes, if anyone does have some good ideas and some stories relating to the broader economy, then I'd be very much appreciative from hearing from you.
Great stuff. Yeah. Thanks very much for making time, Matt. You're a good guy, and I always appreciate your insights. And thanks again.
You too, Dan. A pleasure, and anytime. Happy to love to come back on again at sometime in the future.
Cheers. Take it easy. See ya. Bye.
Okay. Bye. Hey. Bye.